From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The UN debate over a tough new Iraq resolution is about to break later this week. The Security Council is expected to tally up its vote. It's been a huge battle of wills. President Bush says he wants the UN to stand up. Critics say he wants it to roll over. This hour, the superpower and the United Nations. First tonight, the latest from the Turkish elections. A once struggling Islamic party pulled off a landslide victory in Turkey's national elections yesterday. The Justice and Development Party, which goes by the initials AK or AUK, and campaigned on a pro-Western, moderately Islamic agenda, took more than 34% of the vote. Earlier, I spoke with Eileen Prusher, Istanbul bureau chief for the Christian Science Monitor. I asked her to describe the mood in Turkey after the historic vote.
Well, I think people are watching in a bit of awe and wondering exactly what exactly this is going to mean for Turkey. We know that the AK Party, their leaders have a sort of Islamist background, but throughout this entire election campaign, they've expressed a moderate tone. They haven't shown themselves to be in any way anti-Western or trying to make any radical changes in Turkey. But in fact, as you said, this has been a landslide, and this means that they're throwing out all of the politicians and people who have been in government in the last few years. So we know for certain from what we've heard that things are going to change, and we're not quite sure yet at what pace they will change or what are the first things that the AK Party might take on when they take power.
Who in Turkey appears to be, what sector of society appears to be the real stronghold of this new party coming to power, and who might be seen as opposing this party as a class or group?
Certainly, the majority of people who have voted for the AK Party are conservative people. You could say the conservative middle class or even struggling working class, if you will. I mean, Turkey has been in a recession for the last 2 years. You have about 2 million people who are jobless. The economy has shrunk by 10% in the last year. So there are a lot of people out there who are voting for AK Party in part because they think that the current regime that's going out of power now has not handled the economic crisis very well. That's one thing. But you also do get sort of the conservative voters, almost if you could say from the Turkish heartland, the people who feel that they've been neglected by the sort of big city interests and intelligentsia in Ankara and in Istanbul. So, for example, even though you get, let's say, about 35% of the Turkish public voting for the AK Party, this week I was in the very center of the country in a city called Kayseri, and there about 55-60% of the people were voting for the AK Party. I wouldn't say that the people there were fundamentalist, but they do feel that perhaps more traditional values in this country, which is a predominantly Muslim country, should be taken into consideration when formulating the country's policies.
If the AK Party takes more than 276 seats, and it looks like they will, I guess, it will be the first time any Islamic party has come to power on its own since the foundation of the Turkish Republic in 1923. Is there a chance of Turkey moving away from its powerfully secular roots?
That's a question I think that's on everyone's minds right now, and the answer that we seem to be hearing is not something that's likely to happen, at least immediately. In the long term, it's not out of the question, but what we're seeing now is that the AK Party doesn't want to be seen to be making any moves that would be seen to be taking down the bricks in the sort of secular state that Atatürk, the founder of modern Turkey, built up 80 years ago. In fact, the predecessors of the AK Party, they were called the Welfare Party, in 97 were sort of forced out of power by Turkey's military because they were trying to take Turkey away a little bit from this separation of mosque and state, if you will, and bring a little bit more of an Islamic flavor to Turkey. That's a real balance here. On some level, Turkey is a democracy. On another level, there's also a very powerful military here that Turks see as sort of the guardians of the secular state. And it's not quite clear where the lines could be drawn. And if this party, for example, tries to make too many changes too quickly, we could sometime in the near future or in a few years, we could see the military intervene and prevent the government from making any really significant changes to Turkey's secular and pro-Western outlook.
The Islamic connections could be tested very soon if and when the United States goes to war with Iraq. How is that likely to play now with the new party coming into power?
What I've heard has sort of been twofold. On the one hand, they say that they value their relationship with the United States. At the same time, I've also heard them say that they're very much against the idea of having any kind of war in Iraq, which they see as a destabilizing factor in the region. They're a little bit afraid that any kind of regime change in Iraq could actually encourage Kurdish separatism.
And Eileen, put a face on this party's leadership coming into power now. Who's going to be at the head?
That's sort of the million-dollar question here from what we've seen. I mean, of course, the leader is Recep Tayyip Erdogan. He's this charismatic figure who was, in the 90s, the mayor of Istanbul. He won a lot of support then. Some people said he did a fantastic job as mayor. On the other hand, he also served a jail term because he read from a poem that was found to be making allusions between, you know, the mosque and its minarets serving as bayonets, and it was sort of an allegory for militancy. Now, the number two person in the party is Abdullah Gül. He's a very interesting figure who is considered by many people that I've spoken with to be a bit more moderate than Mr. Erdogan, very sort of middle of the road, seems to be respected in diplomatic circles, speaks English very well. He is a potential person who will end up being the prime minister if indeed this government takes power, let's say, in the next week or so, and Mr. Erdogan has been banned from a constitutional court from serving as the prime minister because of this conviction that I mentioned.
Eileen, very quick last question. With the outcome of this election, is Turkey on a more or less stable path?
I wouldn't say that it's not on a stable path. People were concerned that the markets in Turkey would really be rattled by the AK Party's election. And in fact, from what I saw today, it seems that they did well. However, you know, it's very possible that this party will see this kind of vote from the public as a sort of mandate to make very significant changes in Turkey. But in the meantime, what we're seeing from the party is a sort of moderate voice and an attempt to sort of reassure the world that Turkey is not going to change radically overnight.
Eileen Prusher, thanks for joining us.
You're very welcome.
Eileen Prusher is Istanbul Bureau Chief for the Christian Science Monitor. She spoke with us earlier today. It's come down to a struggle over six words. France wants the UN to decide when to pull the trigger on war with Iraq. They want the words, when established by the Security Council in the Iraq resolution. It's a little phrase with big consequences and deep meaning. It is at the heart of the quiet struggle raging between the United States and the United Nations. In one corner, the U.S., the world's sole superpower with a president who wants UN backing but is more than willing to go it alone. In the other corner, the UN, the 57-year-old world body worried about unchecked American power and the UN's future as a multilateral institution. The U.S. hasn't paid its UN dues in full, it's rejected a bevy of international agreements, and now many diplomats feel it's bullying the Security Council into rallying around Washington's war or risk being trampled. The whole debate is about two issues, said one Security Council envoy recently. One is Iraq. The other is U.S. power in the world. The second issue is the bigger part of the debate. So where do you stand, listeners, for U.S. power or U.N. authority? Can we honestly have both? Is the United States gutting the U.N. or giving it some spine? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now is Ruth Wedgwood, Senior Fellow in International Organizations and International Law at the Council on Foreign Relations. Good evening and welcome, Ruth Wedgwood.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. Ruth, bring us right up to the moment, if you can. Negotiations have been going on for weeks now. Colin Powell says he expects a break in that this week, and then there's word today that a deal may be very close. Has the Security Council gotten over the hump yet? Do you know?
Hard to tell from the outside. I mean, the positions that are being taken are ones that are perfectly predictable. I think France must have a sense at this point that the debate has gone on for so long that if it's not brought to closure soon, that the rather kind of forced march U.S. timeline for going into Iraq will be overdue, and therefore the council's in danger of being bypassed.
So what's your take on this whole chapter, Ruth Wedgwood? George Bush has laid down the gauntlet. He said, I don't want the U.N. to become another League of Nations. The U.N. risks irrelevance if it doesn't step up here. Saddam Hussein has put his thumb in its eye if the U.N. doesn't respond. What's the point of the U.N.? We'll go it alone. Is the president bucking up the U.N., or is he, by insisting on the American agenda, undercutting it?
Well, I guess I would hesitate to call it an American agenda. The norm that's in question here is a norm that was laid down by the Security Council in 1991, and that's the norm that says that as the condition of the ceasefire, as a condition of the Allies not going to Baghdad in 1991, that Saddam had to agree to and was required to disarm himself of all weapons of mass destruction. And to be sure, that put Iraq in a unique status among all nations of the world. I mean, the debate that's going on really need have nothing to do with a broader theory of preemptive self-defense or do you like George Bush or not, but rather has to do with, I think, the desire to give indeed some spine.
So you come down.
It's meant to be a very important disarmament condition.
But yet we see clearly in the UN and hear from around the world resistance to the idea of going to war. It's been widely painted as Washington's war, but you don't see it that way. You in fact would see the president's perspective here that this is calling on the UN to stand up to its own requirements.
Well, people who have followed the UN over a decade, I think, often have a sense of heartbreak on this and other issues. Take Rwanda, take Bosnia. Mm-hmm. Time after time, there is a kind of a temporizing mood in the UN often that they don't want to recognize that from time to time the use of force is an instrumental evil but a necessary evil. And so on Bosnia, on Rwanda, they didn't step up to the plate and they allowed crises to get worse and worse until they ended in genocides. So I don't think it's just this case, but rather a sense that the UN in general temperamentally doesn't like to use force.
What do you make, then, of the UN envoy from one of the five permanent Security Council members saying this week that this is about Iraq, it's also about dealing with U.S. power, and it's more about U.S. power than Iraq? Is that just more of the same from the UN, of temporizing, in your words?
Well,
or is there a real struggle underway to figure out how to have a powerful UN or a UN with adequate authority standing alongside this tremendous superpower?
Well, whether that's an excuse or a damnation of the speaker, I don't know. But four years ago, in 1998, when Saddam was about to kick the inspectors out of the country, you had much the same kind of conversation with the French and the Russians, who couldn't find anything nice to say about the UN weapons inspection regime. The inspectors were too fat and too thin and too fast and too slow and insulting and not suitably cognizant of Iraqi dignity. But Sergei Lavrov, who's my erstwhile friend, but the Russian perm rep, was derisive in the extreme of the whole project, frankly, of ridding Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. And now he will say, flat out, there are none. So, yes, it might be convenient to a critic, I suppose, to try to lay over an admixture of U.S. Superpowerdom and hyper puissance in the French. But this has nothing to do with the Kyoto Protocols on global warming. It has nothing to do with the criminal court. This has to do with, I think, enforcing a U.N. norm that was set down 11 years ago and has been scoffed at by Saddam.
So you see the United States in action and in spirit being right in line with the spirit and the letter of what's required by the U.N.?
Well, there is an ongoing debate among lawyers and among diplomats about whether, in general, it's better to have the Security Council be the one to frame the remedy for breaches of its own norms. But I do think the U.S. position is coherent, which is that when the Allies who were kicking Saddam out of his Kuwait adventure in 91, when they laid back their troops, it was their ceasefire that was, in a sense, being made conditioned upon Iraqi disarmament. And also, I suppose, that there's a kind of a enough-is-enough rule that the council might be able to interpose itself at periods to frame issues and try to create modalities.
But it's time to get going here. Ruth Wedgwood, stand by. We've got to take a short break. We're talking about the U.S. and the U.N. tonight. Who do you want to be the dominant global power, the U.S. or the U.N.? And is George Bush truly strengthening the U.N.? bolstering its resolve, or is he rolling over the UN? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the United States and the United Nations and asking if the superpower is strengthening or rolling over the UN. We want to get you in on the conversation. Does the UN avoid the fate of the League of Nations by cooperating with Washington or resisting it? Can we ever count on the UN to take the lead in dealing with dangerous rogue nations? And is the UN the future of the planet, or is it doomed to be brushed by? We're at 1-800-423-8255 tonight. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We've been talking with Ruth Wedgwood, Senior Fellow in International Organizations at the Council on Foreign Relations. I want to welcome into our conversation now James Bone. He's New York correspondent for the Times of London. Good evening and welcome, James Bone.
Evening, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for being with us. James, you've been in the halls of the UN over these last 6 or 7 weeks listening to the whole conversation since George Bush showed up and said, let's go, don't be irrelevant, get on board, we're going to Iraq. What's the mood in the UN? Do people see Bush as having brought some spine to the United Nations or rolling over it?
I think the prevailing mood is relief. I think there was a lot of fear before Bush came on September 12th to give his speech to the UN General Assembly that the Americans under Bush would just go unilaterally and do their own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there was an enormous sigh of relief when he decided to go what the Americans call the UN track. And the fact that the Americans, despite repeated threats as part of the negotiating tactics of walking away from the UN, are still there after 7 weeks, I think is also a matter of great relief to most other UN members.
But that makes it sound as though just engaging the superpower for 7 weeks is sufficient. I mean, does the UN come away from this with more than just looking good because they managed to talk to the giant for 7 weeks? Do they come away with a real material uprightness in their role?
Well, you have to understand what's going on. What's going on is that people are trying to define the new international system post September 11th, 2001. Mm-hmm. And the issue is whether, having been attacked, the world's only remaining superpower can go around, romp around the world, responding unilaterally, or whether it's going to operate within the existing international system, which is defined by the UN. And that's the battleground, really. I mean, a lot of the discussion that's been going on, particularly between the Americans and the French, has not been so much about Iraq, but has been about the rules of the road for the new era.
Mm-hmm.
And the French really wanting to pin the Americans down and make them work within the framework of the UN, which gives the other countries some leverage over the Americans. And the Americans testing to see how much they're free to operate by themselves and how much they really need to work through the UN so they can assemble allies.
Ruth Wedgwood, do you see it the same way? James Bone describes this as the UN kind of coaxing the wild bull back into the barn after we had the fire. Is this a triumph for the UN simply because the United States has sat still for 6 or 7 weeks to talk?
Well, I have to say, if I may, as a loving critic, that it's a typical UN in the sense that we've been spending now 7.5, 8 weeks, which should have been devoted to inspections, instead doing syntactical critique. One friend of mine who took 11th grade French with me said it reminded her of rédaction de texte when you go over Molière to see how he's using words.
Well, but is it really just about words? I mean, the whole point has been here, has it not, to give the Security Council a continuing role in the decision about actually going to war?
Well, the bottom line, which the French darn well know, and so do the Russians, is that the Americans are never going to agree to a promise that we will not use force against Iraq unless and until the Council uses the words material breach in their resolution. They've used that word before. There's a cute little head count which shows that the number of times that the Council has used similar language of flagrant violation and continuing violation is above a dozen. I think they have 8 material breaches, 2 breaches, 7 not full in full compliances, 2 flagrants, 1 clear and flagrant.
But violation. Material breach is the phrase that by precedent permits permits military action.
Well, actually not. I mean, it's a funny transposition from the Vienna Convention on the Law of Treaties. There's no magic in it in a UN resolution.
But isn't the U.S. looking at it as a matter of precedent?
Well, it seems to mean something to the Russians and French particularly.
Mm-hmm.
But
saying it doesn't to Washington? I'm sorry, but my understanding has been, Ruth Wedgwood, that Washington wants these words in there because they feel on the back of the phrase material breach, they can go to war later whether the Security Council is still on board or not.
Well, the language has taken on a kind of a life of its own, given the significance with which it was invested by the French and Russians.
I disagree. Ruth, first of all, say hello. I want to say hello to you. So I wasn't able to say hello to you. But I disagree with Ruth's analysis in several points. One is that material breach was originally an invention of British Foreign Office lawyers who are legendary for their ability to make everything a drafting fix, resolve the most difficult issues by fixing up the language. And the theory of material breach back in 1991, which I remember well when I was covering them, was that if you had a material breach as opposed to a non-material breach of the ceasefire resolution that ended the Gulf War, the original UN authorization for the use of force in the November 1990 resolution 678 would come back into being, and therefore it is very explicitly under that legal theory that was put forward at the time an authorization. It was basically calls off the ceasefire. So the ceasefire has collapsed, and therefore the original authorization of the use of force is back in effect. And so everybody understands. It's not the Russians and the French who understand it that way. It was proposed originally in 1991 by the British, and it's been always understood like that, to the extent that there was a huge battle over it in 1998 before Desert Fox. At that point, the Russians and the French succeeded in getting the resolution, a resolution without the words material breach. They substituted the words material breach with the words flagrant violation, which Ruth mentioned, and that was meant to be fall short of a material breach such as the ceasefire would collapse. And if you look at the speeches that accompanied that resolution in, I think it was either late October or early November 1998, you'll see that the Americans were in their speeches using the words material breach, but in the resolution it had these funny words, flagrant violation. The other thing I'd like to say in response to what Ruth was saying was that there's a misperception that the UN has been fiddling around for 7 weeks. What's been happening is Washington's been fiddling around for 7 weeks.
How so, James Bond?
There are effectively two tendencies in Washington to the point of almost being two policies on Iraq. You have what I would call the neoconservative policy represented by Dick Cheney and the Pentagon and possibly the National Security Council. And you have the more internationalist, traditional, and perhaps more realpolitik policy represented by the State Department.
So you're saying and Colin Powell and the others have been playing out their own internal division in New York?
Say it again?
You're saying the Washington has been playing out its own internal argument on the UN stage?
The discussion has been internal in Washington. Most of the discussion has not been taking place in New York, and even the discussion between the Americans and the French has taken a long time. A lot of the time has elapsed because of discussions within Washington about what the hardliners in Washington are willing to give Colin Powell to offer to the Allies. That's what's been going on.
Ruth Wedgwood, I don't want to get lost in the debate over material breach, but yet it's right at the heart of things here. And it now seems that the latest wire story I'm reading today, it looks as though Washington may compromise in some way on this. But the issue is whether or not Washington comes out of the Security Council feeling that it has the freedom to go to war if it wants to.
Well, let me make two points. One is that a material breach is an objective condition. It's a state of fact. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a state of war where whether or not you have a declaration of war, you can be thrust into war just as Lincoln was thrust into war by the South. So you don't need that locution, that phrase in the resolution. Secondly, I think Washington would found this really on a notion of self-defense, that indeed when collective security was breached by Saddam in 1990 by invading Kuwait, the condition for the end of that war of self-defense, was indeed these disarmament conditions. And if the conditions are not met, then the state of war, so to say, resumes, and that becomes a matter of collective self-defense.
There is a problem. There is a problem with using the UN definition of self-defense, because Article 51 of the UN Charter, which is the article that gives the inherent right to self-defense to UN member states, says that the right of self-defense is only invoked after an armed attack. Those are the words, after an armed attack. Now, obviously, there hasn't been an armed attack by the Iraq on the United States, so it's very hard for the United States to just invoke Article 51 to sample like that.
James Bone, Ruth Resward, stand by. We have callers who want to join us, and I want to get them in. Joe's calling from La Crosse, Wisconsin. Hi, Joe. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you. First, let me tell you, it's a pleasure to be joining you folks in conversation. But when you were discussing, you know, three flagrant violations,
yes,
two of this and a partridge in a pear tree.
Right.
I think what we have here is a situation where the United Nations is once again dilly-dallying, and frankly, that's its forte, as is most meditative bodies in this situation, and France tends to lead the dilly-dallying. And what you have is a situation where Washington is taking advantage of it. But one of the things that people forget so quickly is that with few exceptions, and those have tended to be clandestine and badly run, the United States of America has never had a first-strike preemptive policy, and it's not in our best interest to begin doing so right now.
But, Joe, are you saying the United States is taking advantage of the U.N.? How so?
In the sense that that's what they're going to do, and it wants to get it to the point where they come to an agreement. It's trying to make use of the U.N. It's trying, and I really agree with what one of the earlier folks commented, that it's trying to put some spine in the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
Because, frankly, the United Nations as a meditative body could go on indefinitely. You know, a camel is a horse designed by a committee. And the problem here is that in the meantime, in the interim, what's going to happen is that the more aggressive elements in our country's government right now, and they were talking about the neoconservatives and Cheney and so forth,
mm-hmm,
are going to see this as an opportunity to begin to use excessive force whenever it serves our purposes. I mean, if you hear comparisons about how, oh, it goes back to the Vietnam War and Afghanistan and this and that, but the situations that we've become embroiled in as a country were rarely so simply stated as people said, oh, we fought for oil or we fought for this. It was so frequently people who simply thought they knew what was best for us.
Yeah, Joe, we know that. I want to put it to Ruth Wedgwood. Ruth, here it is again. I guess if I get Joe correctly, there. I mean, he wants the UN to stand up and have some more spine. At the same time, there's this concern that the superpower manipulates or uses the UN for its own agenda. When you have such a superpower uncontested, is that something that the UN founders imagined, envisioned, and does it somehow warp the function of the UN, or can they coexist?
Well, the UN Charter actually writes superpowerdom into its own architecture. I mean, people.
But there were two.
Well, there were five, actually.
Yes.
Powers,
mm-hmm,
but that there's an aristocracy of power in the sense that the Charter recognizes that the norms without teeth will not get you home.
But even then, there were five, so at least there would be, our caller Joe may not like this, but at least there would be enough people to have a debate. When there's one that towers so tall, does it twist the UN's function?
Well, I'd first say, thank God there's at least one, because one of the complaints about Europe has,
mm-hmm,
been that it's willfully been cutting its defense budgets, lessening its military time of service. They talk about having a norm of humanitarian intervention, but would have no troops with which to back that up. They have no avionics, no over-the-horizon targeting capability. They are under-investing in the military and have used us to pick up the slack. So I'd say, thank God there's one power that's still interested in enforcement. But I think what cuts beyond all the rhetoric and my superpower is,
mm-hmm,
your freedom fighter,
mm-hmm,
is the bottom line. Time has passed. The International Institute for Strategic Studies in,
mm-hmm,
London estimates that Saddam could be as close to 6 months away from a bomb. Some other friends of mine think it could be much earlier if he got fissile material. So the bottom line substantive question, which I think we should keep our eyes on, is Saddam with a bomb an acceptable circumstance in the region? If we think it's not,
mm-hmm,
then this kind of procedural perfectionism where we want to cross every French I and dot every Russian T, I think will seem rather hollow.
James, what's your sense from inside the UN? Do you have a lot of delegates thinking along the same lines as Ruth Wedgwood? Thank goodness the United States is blowing an invigorating wind through here. Will get us to act?
People talk about the UN being given spine. Of course, the UN is an invertebrate body. It doesn't have an army, and it doesn't have any possibility of getting an army. So it only has to rely on the kind of calcium quotient that's provided to it by other people. I do agree very much with one thing that Ruth said just now, which is that it's all about whether Saddam gets a nuclear bomb or not. It seems to me there's a great deal of obfuscation, probably deliberate obfuscation in this country, about the relationship between the war in Iraq and the war on terror, so-called, and that's a very controversial issue all through the Islamic world, where a war in Iraq will hinder the war on terror because it will make Muslim extremists more extreme and make it harder for the,
mm-hmm,
secular Arab governments to crack down on the Islamist movement. And it's also very controversial in Europe, where people don't really understand the connection between Iraq and the war on terror. I think that people, it's important for Americans to understand, there would have been a war against Iraq whether or not there was September 11th. It's very important to understand that.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the war against Iraq is a very conventional war. You have a sworn enemy, he's about to obtain a nuclear weapon, and you try and stop him.
And the Bush administration came into power talking about that. If you hold on one moment, James Bone, I want to bring a caller in. Evan's calling from Green Bay, Wisconsin. Hi, Evan. You're on the air.
Hi, everybody. Good evening.
Evening.
I'd just like to say, I guess on a side note, I have been a member of the United States Army Reserves. I served a couple of years on active duty, of course, and then went to the reserve sites.
Mm-hmm.
I am in an ammo supply unit that served in Desert Storm for 6 months during the Desert Storm the first time.
Okay.
I think that after speaking with a bunch of my fellow soldiers this weekend and things like that,
mm-hmm.
I think that a lot of us more so are worried that in the future, if we do decide to go into a conflict, rather than sitting on our hands now, we're more worried. I think everybody would agree with me that we're all worried more about the chemical warfare.
And are you worried that the long conversation at the UN it will make you more vulnerable to that, Evan?
I mean, the simple truth is that I think that if we go now, before he has more time to prepare, the casualties would probably be a lot lower, if not, I mean, substantially less than if we decide to go 6 or 7 months from now.
That's a personal and direct interest in getting off the mark and getting off quickly. Evan, thanks for your call. James Bone, there's an American soldier saying, I don't care what the origin is, I'd rather do it now than later.
Well, I mean, I think the only reason you ever go to war is to avoid a worse war later on, one that's more disadvantageous to it. Otherwise, there's no reason ever to go to war. So I think that logic is sound.
Ruth Wedgwood, I hear in your observations a fair amount of comfort then in the relationship between Washington and New York, that Washington is playing the role that it should. It's the power, it's got the teeth, and it's encouraging the UN to stand up and act.
Well, the relationship between unilateralism and multilateralism is sort of mysterious. It's almost like a catechism of the church.
Sure is.
Because the irony is that to make multilateralism work, you often do need a unilateral engine, which may intimate but not say that it's going to do it anyway, that says it'll take the onus and the expense of the operation. But it's surely the truth that James's metaphor was wonderful. It never occurred to me. An invertebrate body. but the UN itself is a normative umbrella. It does not have any enforcement capability. Often I think it doesn't want any. And often it does divert itself into these rhetorical side rails where, because they do paper for a living, they think paper will rule the world.
Boy, that makes it sound as though makes one wonder why we even had this 6 weeks conversation if it's such an invertebrate.
I have to say that this whole phrase, the 6 week conversation at the UN, first of all, it's 7 weeks, but I mean it's a slightly silly phrase because it's not a conversation at the UN. It's hardly happened here. Only in the last couple of weeks has it even come to the UN. It's been a conversation between mostly between Washington and Paris.
We take your point, James Boyne. We're going to take a short break. We'll come back and pick it up again. We're talking tonight about the U.S. and the U.N. and asking, is the U.S. superpower strengthening or rolling over the United Nations? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about the U.S. and the U.N. and asking, is the superpower strengthening or rolling over the United Nations? Is George Bush truly bolstering the United Nations? Or is he just rolling through? Can we ever count on the United Nations to take the lead in dealing with dangerous rogue nations? And can we have a towering single superpower and a vibrant U.N.? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. My guests tonight are James Bone. He's New York correspondent for the Times of London covering the UN, and Ruth Wedgwood, senior fellow in international organizations and international law at the Council on Foreign Relations. Right now, Daniel's on the line. Hi, Daniel. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you doing, Tom?
Well,
thanks for taking my call.
Thanks. Sure.
Yeah, I just have a couple of things to say. I just think that Bush is just rolling right over the UN on this and is using it as a rubber stamp for, you know, to get things that we want done in the area done.
And are you glad for that or not?
No, I'm not glad for it at all.
Why?
I think it's going to be terribly dangerous to us here within the States, as well as ending up with the deaths of, possibly thousands over there.
You're saying you wish the UN was putting a brake on the move to war?
Well, I don't know what the UN can do at this point. I guess that's one of my troubles, is that, you know, the choice that's being offered is, do what we say or we're going to do it without you, which is no choice at all.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and if we were really concerned whether or not, you know, Iraq was doing what we wanted to be doing, or whether UN, you know, what the UN says we should be doing or they should be doing, then we'd be concerned about, the resolutions against us for Nicaragua, you know, and the reparations that we should be making to them, or the resolutions against Israel, which I think are, you know, there's nearly twice as many.
Hang on. Let me put that to James Bone. James, what about this notion that when the U.S. says, when George Bush explicitly says, approve this or we'll do it ourselves, how is that received at the United Nations?
It's received as a negotiating tactic. I mean, everybody knows that the Americans wouldn't be dickering around at the UN for 7 weeks unless they needed the Allies. They're not there for fun. You know, they need the Allies. They don't just need the Allies for the war. They can probably win the war by themselves,
mm-hmm.
but they need the Allies for the reconstruction of Iraq. This idea that was floated in the New York Times of having an American military government with an American military commander as running Iraq is a complete non-starter. And, you know, it will end up as some kind of UN umbrella. And the Americans know that, and everyone at the UN knows that. And that was what gives them negotiating power. Look what happened in Afghanistan. Look how much the Americans have needed their allies to run Afghanistan after they successfully waged the war.
So you're saying the power is not as much in George Bush's hand as he pretends, and he knows it.
He needs the allies. He doesn't have the allies. He's been at the UN messing around for 7 weeks trying to get allies.
And it looks as though he may soon have them.
Now he's going to get the allies, but it's taken 7 weeks. It's taken a certain amount of concessions. It's taken a certain delay in the American timetable for war. It hasn't taken huge compromises, but it's taken some compromises.
And has it left the United Nations where it rightfully should be in terms of being the organization that gives the lays on the hands, that gives the global authority and blessing?
Well, it means that the post-World War II international system will continue for the moment after 9/11 instead of becoming a different international system with a more unilateralist approach as some of the neoconservatives want. So I don't know whether that's mm-hmm. the rightful approach or not the rightful approach, but that's the factual answer to the question at the moment.
Dan, thanks for your call. Sandro's calling from Smithfield, Rhode Island. Hi, Sandro. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Good to have you.
I just want to make an observation, or rather share a feeling. I do believe that Bush is rolling over the UN. However, there's almost a feeling as if we have no choice. The UN just seems to primarily play the role of a passive mediator. They really don't seem to take an active or assertive role in shaping or following up on some of the resolutions that are agreed to. So it almost feels as if the U.S. is acting because there's no faith that the U.N. will take action. And I guess my question to James and Ruth would be, would they like to see the U.N. adopt a more assertive or aggressive role throughout, you know, the shaping of global relations?
Let's put it to them. Thanks for your call, Sandra. Ruth Wedgwood, I mean, you've pointed out that this is an organization without a standing army, but at the same time, it can degenerate into a talking shop sometimes. Would you like to see the UN, as Sandra asks, more assertive, or is this the right kind of relationship between the UN and its power aristocrat?
It's like asking whether you'd like to have a platypus fly. It's not a creature that flies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Saddam has been brilliant at playing on the small fractures in alliance politics and just trying to lever off allies in the Security Council over the last 11 years to try to play upon people's incentives that are commercial or imperial in the region to try to make it clear that it's hard to have an alliance confront a single enemy. And the second problem with the UN often is that this premise that delay is cost-free.
Mm-hmm.
And the point I always like to make about the original war, Foreign Minister Primakov was
the Gulf War, 91.
Yeah, 91. Foreign Minister Primakov of the Soviet Union was allowed one last chance to go in of Russia
mm-hmm.
To see if he could persuade Saddam to cease and desist and withdraw from Kuwait on his own. And that sounded like a wonderful Habermasian ideal speech my academic colleagues would love. But in that period of 2.5 months, that's exactly when Saddam weaponized his biological reagents and put them into aerial bombs and warheads. We should not, I mean, it may well be that we need the time anyway, but we should not assume that talk is always free. And I do think that there can become this kind of celebration of gestures
process
for their own sake.
Mm-hmm. Sandro, thanks for your call. Gregory's on the line. Hi, Gregory. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I want to build on the last caller's point, and he mentioned having a more aggressive role or stance for the United Nations.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we really have a very important decision point, really, here about whether or not the United States is going to assist the UN into being in a position where it can take on an active role as a true, really, an international government, which is a next logical step, in my opinion, of the evolution of governments from chiefdom to city-state to nation-state.
Mm-hmm.
We have had blocks, and now we have an opportunity to sort of move to the next level. The United States, because it is a benevolent, if you will, let's assume for a minute, enlightened superpower, has an opportunity to really step into the situation and say, we're going to help provide you the muscle necessary to be effective here. And I think that's really what Colin Powell is trying to do, is sort of nudge Bush into a role of supporting the UN to be effective. And I'm interested in whether or not your guests feel, especially your representative from the London Times, feels
mm-hmm.
that Europe sees an opportunity here for the United States really in being a power that can act with restraint in a sense, providing the UN with a real, legitimate way to operate going forward in the 21st century.
We got it, Gregory. James Bone, how about it? Here is a question. It always rises of ultimately what the UN should and will be and whether its authority grows above the nation states. And you know there are deep divisions in this country about that, the black helicopter crowd that fears that above all else. And in Gregory, we hear a caller who's open to it. Does the UN, if we can speak of the UN as a collective, does it even aspire to this more assertive, aggressive, authoritative global role?
Well, of course, the UN is a collection of an organization of member nations. So the UN doesn't aspire to anything beyond what its constitution says, which is the UN Charter, and the constitution clearly defines it as an organization of member nations. On the other hand, the UN does play an increasingly important role in what Ruth mentioned, which is the normative function, basically setting norms of international law. We've had a huge row in the last year about the creation of a new international criminal court, which
mm-hmm.
the Americans reject because they think it impinges on America's sovereignty and
mm-hmm.
its own constitutional freedoms, and most of the rest of the world embraces and thinks it's a good idea. I don't think the reason that the Bush administration is taking the UN route at the moment is to bolster the UN so it can become an eventual world government. Quite the contrary.
Mm-hmm.
I, as I said before, I think the reason that the Americans are at the UN is much more realpolitik. They need the allies, and that's the place they can find the allies.
But Gregory asks, and there is part of at least American society that always wonders if there is no evolutionary trend toward more authority drifting up to a central power. You're saying that constitutionally the UN does not aspire to that.
I'm saying that same time, that constitutionally it is unable to aspire to that. A lot of people
mm-hmm.
who work there aspire to that and are committed internationalists. And in many ways, the treaty and norm-making functions of the UN does create a kind of international government, even though the secretariat itself isn't able to become a world government. I mean, you know, you have an international criminal court now established by treaty.
Mm-hmm.
That would be a step towards what people would consider an eventual world government. That is
yes.
a historic step,
mm-hmm.
but that isn't actually the what the UN Secretariat is doing.
Mm-hmm.
Ruth
Wedgwood, please.
Might make just two quick points. One is that anybody who's seen the practical difficulties of working at the UN, whether in administering East Timor or
mm-hmm.
Kosovo, or even getting adequate numbers of translators,
mm-hmm.
this is the idea of it having become a world government will seem a practical guffaw. On the ICC, I do think the point to be made is that the U.S. concern about the criminal court is in part that it might well clip the wings of the one enforcement mechanism that's left. The concern about the ICC is not sovereignty per se as such alone, but rather that the court would have an unrealistic account of how one needs to use military power.
But we hear James Bone saying that, in fact, something historic has happened in that the United States, over these last months, has been brought back into the fold of the UN post 9/11, when it might have decided, the hell with it, we're doing things our way, we're in danger.
Well, we did the same thing in Kosovo, where even though we didn't ultimately get a resolution for humanitarian intervention, we talked to our allies in a kind of a ad hoc multilateralism, and the UN came back in afterwards under Resolution 1244 for the reconstruction of Kosovo. So I think that one thing that happens is a kind of role-playing where sometimes the UN doesn't want to pull the trigger for all kinds of psychological and political reasons of its members, but is content to do reconstruction.
I think there was a much greater danger this time of America going it alone permanently. And I think that, you know, because of 9/11, I think the international system has changed and America's posture in the world has changed, and America has embraced this idea of kind of preemptive defense. America's defense doctrine, after decades of being a kind of deterrence-based kind of defensive posture, mm-hmm. has become more like Israel's posture, which is a preemptive posture. And the question is, how is that incorporated into the international system now? And I think that basically what happened was, first the British and then the French have kind of persuaded the Americans to try and continue through the UN. Now, maybe that doesn't work for the Americans over the next few years. It may be that they find that they can't adequately protect themselves against this this kind of menace of Islamism within the confines of the UN. But at the moment,
but right now they're trying it.
They are trying it. Mm. And as I said, I don't think the war against Iraq has much, if anything, to do with the war against terror.
Let's get one more call. Paul's calling from Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Paul. You're on the air.
Good evening, everyone. Tom, in your introduction, your question asked, in a sense, what's the role of the U.S. vis-a-vis the U.N.
Mm-hmm.
with respect to rogue nations? That
yes.
was the phrase you used. But mm-hmm. what that question leaves out of the equation is that very often the rogue nation is the U.S. So why are we talking about what sort of role the U.S. should play with respect to the U.N. when often it's the U.S. that needs the international policing?
We've got the question, Paul. Our time is short. I'll let you go, and thank you for it. But James Bone, pick this up, because this is a recurring theme from our callers, that it is sometimes, it can be, it may be now in certain respects, the U.S. that's a rogue nation at moments. How does the U.N. deal with the superpower occasionally? Well, you're saying people were afraid just a few months ago that it was off the reservation permanently.
First of all, I don't think it's true that the United States is a rogue nation. I mean, the whole concept of a rogue nation was Madeleine Albright's phrase, and was basically defined as small countries that try and buck the international legal norms that are established by the major powers through the UN.
But big countries can't be rogues?
Say it again?
But big countries can't be rogues?
Well, big countries with vetoes on the Security Council mm-hmm. probably can't be rogues, no.
And that's the way it is.
Mm.
James Bone, I'm afraid we're out of time. Thank you very much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
James Bone is New York correspondent for the Times of London. And Ruth Wedgwood, thank you so much for being with
thank
us.
Thank you.
Ruth Wedgwood is senior fellow in international organizations and international law at the Council on Foreign Relations. Listeners, you can continue this United Nations conversation online. Log on to onpointradio.org and click on Forums. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sets and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287.